We made this.
I'm Carl Sweeney.
And I'm Tony Black.
And welcome to The Discourse and The Movie Palace. Okay, so we are back on The Discourse. Welcome, everybody. Welcome as well if you are listening via the Movie Palace feed. And I hope if this is the first time you are listening to what we do on The Discourse, I hope you enjoy it. So on The Discourse, we take a regular look, usually several times a week, isn't it, Tony? What's going on in the world of popular culture, really. You know, we have an emphasis on film and television, but other things come up too, including, you know, music and podcasts and sometimes political things, depending on really just what we want to talk about each week. So, do you want to just quickly remind people where they can find The Discourse online and things like that?
Yeah, currently, until it explodes, we're on Twitter at PodTheDiscourse, which is where we're mainly online, really. That's it. And but you can also contact us on email at contactthediscourse@gmail.com. So if you do like the show, drop us a line and let us know what you liked, any suggestions, etc. So that's basically where you can find us, really. Oh, and please give us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts as well, if you like this, because that will really help us. So yeah, cheers for that if you do.
Yeah, it does help, because what it means is that shows with more ratings and higher ratings are displayed more prominently to people, I think. And that's a big bonus if you're on those platforms. Yeah. So yeah, that would be much appreciated if you could do that, listeners. We thought we'd release this episode of The Discourse also on the Movie Palace feed, because we felt it was a fairly natural fit. Because on this episode, we are talking about the greatest films of all time.
Dun, dun, dun!
At least the greatest films of all time, as indicated by the 2022 Sight and Sound poll, both of film critics and also of directors. We'll contextualise that as we go along, but basically that's what this episode of The Discourse is.
Yeah.
Usually what we would do is take a handful of topics and discuss them, but here we've got really one main topic we're going to drill into. I think, Tony, the best place to start is with what the Sight and Sound poll is, and does it matter, or why does it matter, perhaps? So I think I had teed this up on an earlier episode of The Discourse, actually, but I think now that the moment has come, it's quite natural to just take stock and revisit that slightly. So I'll tee this up then. So Sight and Sound is a British film magazine that's been going since the 1930s. Ever since 1952, they have done a critics poll of the greatest films of all time, and it's a critics poll that happens once every 10 years. So, of course, 2022 is the latest iteration of that. So what has happened over the course of that period of time is that, obviously, the film that has been designated the greatest of all has changed. So I think the first time the poll was run, The Bicycle Thief was number one. That was 1952. Then in 1962, the Orson Welles film Citizen Kane took the top spot, where it remained for quite a long time. So 72, 82, 92, and 2002. So it got to the point where people were wondering if Citizen Kane would ever be toppled, as it were. And that's what happened last time, is that it was toppled, because Alfred Hitchcock's film Vertigo supplanted Citizen Kane, having steadily climbed the ladder in the previous few polls. So, yeah, that's what the Sight and Sound poll is. That's the sort of recent history. We're going to talk shortly about the 2022 poll. But, Tony, what would you say about whether this matters? If it does matter, why does it matter? Why should people listening to this podcast care what a British film magazine thinks is the are the greatest films of all time?
Well, I mean, probably first and foremost is the fact that Sight and Sound is probably one of the most reputable film magazines on the planet, really, in terms of longevity. I mean, it's been going like ridiculously long, like nearly 100 years. It's been around as almost as long as cinema. It's very, very well regarded. It has, you know, it's connected heavily to the British film industry, which is, you know, itself very well regarded these days. And, you know, it polls, in this case, it was double the amount of critics this time, wasn't it? It was 1,600 critics as opposed to 800. And it polls, genuinely, I would say, many of the greatest critic movie minds out there in this day and age, really. except you and I, because we didn't get an invite. But we will in 2032. I'm pretty confident of that. But, you know, you can't have it all. should have been 1602, Carl, but, you know. So I think on that basis, it's worthy. But, you know, I think also the fact that there are several big lists of acclaimed movies out there that do shape the sort of discourse around cinema in many ways, certainly within a certain remit of people, probably more online people, realistically. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got things like the AFI 100 movies, I think it is. You know, there are those kind of polls. I don't think the IMDb 250 probably counts. But, you know, people love that list.
With apologies, you know, to our friends who podcast at the 250, Darren and Andrew.
Yeah. Darren and Andrew. No, you make it worthwhile, guys, if you're listening.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's. I think there is, and I think people just love lists. Ultimately, people love lists, really. So I think there is worth in doing it. Although that's always part of the debate, isn't it? You know, whenever these things come around, and particularly this time, because this has been the most discussed version of this, I think, ever in history, thanks to social media.
Yeah.
The big part of the debate is, why do we need lists? Do we need lists? Oh, this is also arbitrary. Oh, this is also, you know, and it's like, yeah, okay, but why shouldn't we have lists? Why shouldn't we do this? It's a way also of revisiting these films and getting a lot of them back into circulation in many ways. So there's quite a fair few bits to it. I don't know, what do you think? Is there more to it than I've thought of there?
No, I think that's quite a good summary of it, really. I think, yeah, generally the Sight and Sound list would be seen by a lot of people as the gold standard of this kind of list. At the same time, I would say, obviously, any list like this can never be truly definitive. So I think there's a limit to how seriously you should take it in a certain way. So what I mean is, I think the best way to approach a list like this is kind of as a portal to discoveries, really. So I think that the idea of quality is subjective and is always kind of contextually dependent. So what we judge to be great shifts substantially over time as the wider culture shifts, as time moves on, etc. So I think you can never have, like I say, a definitive list that everybody's going to agree on. But I think these kinds of things can be useful if you want to broaden your palette, if that makes sense. So we're going to come on to talk about the results of the new list in a moment. But for example, I went down the list quickly last night when it was published. So we're recording this the day after the list was published. I went quickly down the list and totted up that I have seen, I think, 75% of the films on the top 100 list. So that leaves me with 25% of films there that I haven't seen. And this gives me an incentive to track them down, really, and to, like I say, widen the canvas, broaden the palette. So on that level, I find lists like this a good conversation starter. And I think there are issues with them. I think maybe there are issues with this list that we can talk about in relation to the reaction to it. But I think if you approach it in the right spirit, Tony, you can sort of get things from them. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, definitely. Yeah, I think the big thing from it is, and I haven't actually totted up how many I've seen on there. I know I've seen only 4 of the 10 at the top. So, you know, we'll get to that in a bit. But I know it will be less than you because, you know, you are the more cultured film goer than me. Or you are. I spent too many years watching, like, terrible comedies and, you know, bad Transformers sequels. So, you know, it's...
Well, yeah, there was an episode where you'd watched the Super Mario Brothers movie after promising to watch a Jean-Luc Godard film, wasn't
exactly.
it? So maybe there is something to that.
Hence proving my point, yeah. So, but yeah, I think the key to these things and is the discovery of stuff. You know, I think that's the big thing. It, you know, already, and I won't stick to it because I never do completely. But already, I'm thinking, oh, I'm going to watch like as many of these as I can because a lot of them are streaming on various, you know, blah 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 blah. And then, you know, I'll get to number 27 on the list, that's Showa, and it's like 10 hours long. I'll go, you know, although I did start watching that not so long back, actually, and it was very good. But
I once watched that over the course of a week. I think week, me and the missus, we spent 2 hours each night watching Showa. So it was an undertaking, God, but it is worth
that's
it.
That's a fun week, eh?
It was a heavy week, but it was worth it. I think it's a good film. But yeah, carry on.
Yeah, you know, it is. But, you know, it's that intent doesn't always last with everything else going on. But, you know, inevitably I will see things from this list now, some of these great movies that I wouldn't have seen were this list not there. And I think that's the key. It gets these things out there. It remind it, it either promotes films that people have never heard of, you know, and I think we'll get to that much later when we talk about what's towards the top. But like, you know, it reminds people of things that they may not have seen. And, you know, on that basis, it's really worth it, because you will definitely get people discover movies they never would have watched were it not for this.
Yeah. Okay, I think that's true. And I think with that in mind, let's dive into the 2022 poll then. So we'll start with a critics poll. I think there are a couple of interesting things from the director's poll I wanted to highlight as well later. But the critics poll is the one that drives a lot of the discourse. So what are the headlines? Well, the big headline is, Tony, that there is a new number one. So I think what we should do is count down in reverse order the top 10.
Yeah,
people can go online to the website, the BFI website, to find the whole list. And I would encourage you to do that. And we'll probably tweet out a link or something when the episode goes live. But the top 10 is interesting to look at. So at number 10, Singing in the Rain. With Stanley Donen and Gene Kelly, musical from 1951, one of my very favourite films, so glad to see that there. At number 9, Man with a Movie Camera, so Jiga Vertov's 1929 film, kind of an experimental piece, which I've seen many years ago. Is this one of the ones you haven't seen, Tony?
Yep, that would be. Yep. I've heard of it, but the still that they always show is The Eye. That's the one on the, on the list as well, That Eye. So yeah, no, is it good?
It is good indeed, yeah. I think, like I say, it's been 20-odd years since I've seen this film. So I'm due a rewatch, to be honest. But I do remember sitting down to watch it and it being very good. So, and I think it was high on the 2012 list as well, actually, if I remember rightly. Then at number 8, climbing the list, is Mulholland Drive, David Lynch's film from 2001. Mm. So I'm guessing that's one you have seen.
It's not, actually.
My goodness.
I know. It is on my list to do. That jumped quite a big way, didn't it, though, I think, from last time?
Yeah, I think last time there were only two films from the 2000s, you know, from the new millennium in the list, and both of them have jumped into the top 10 at this time. So we'll come to the other one. Number 7 on the list I haven't seen, I will confess. It's Beau Travail, Claire Denis' film from 1998. I've seen a few Claire Denis films. I actually watched a Claire Denis film the day the poll came out, because one of her new film, Both Sides of the Blade, is on Mubi, and I watched that. I haven't seen this one. I've always known this is regarded as possibly her strongest film, but I haven't got around to it.
Yeah, I the only Denis film I watched was High Life. This
Robert
year.
Pattinson.
Yeah, and I wasn't a big fan. I think it was a bit too slow and odd for me. But you know, maybe I need to watch it again. But what do I know? What do I know? I didn't even get to vote, Carl. So what do I know?
Speaking of slow and odd, at number 6, 2001 A Space Odyssey, Stanley Kubrick's 1968 film, which I had wondered if this was going to jump all the way up to number 1, actually. I could see, I had no insider information or anything, but I could see an eventuality where that happened, but it's number 6.
That was being rumoured, though, wasn't it? I think a lot of people thought it was going to hit the top spot, actually. So, yeah. I think it should be higher than 6.
Well,
but there you go.
We'll come back to this in relation to its placing on the director's poll, which is interesting.
Yeah.
Number 5, like I said, two films last time from the new millennium made the list and have jumped into the top 10 this time. And the second one is In the Mood for Love, which is Wong Kar-wai's film from 2001, which is a beautiful film, Tony. I would encourage you to see that if you haven't already.
I haven't, yep.
Number 4, so we're getting to the business end of the list now, Tokyo Story, Yasujirō Ozu's film from 1953.
This always gets in there, doesn't it? This one.
Yeah.
Like, have you seen this one?
Yes, I have. Yeah.
Why is this so high up on so many people's lists?
That's a very good question. I think Ozu generally is regarded as a great director with a very distinct approach. I think things like ground level camera placements in his films. I think this is seen as being, I think it's another film on the list of his, isn't there? Late Spring. Mm. I think it's just generally seen as kind of a masterclass of sort of restraint and like a kind of suppressed emotion. So I wasn't surprised. I think again this was very high on the 2012 list, and I wasn't surprised to see that it's still in the top 10, to be fair.
Okay, cool.
Then we get into the top 3, of course. Citizen Kane. Now, I had wondered if Citizen Kane would retain its top spot as well. Yeah. I thought, maybe 2001. And then I could also see a possibility where Vertigo's voting base kind of fragments a bit and Citizen Kane comes back. But no, it's at number 3. Very good film indeed, of course. Great film.
Mm. We talked a little bit about it on a Motion Pictures episode called about Mank, which was about the making of Citizen Kane, wasn't it? So, you know, he was talking a little bit about that. And you've got to do it on the Movie Palace at some point, Carl, surely. Surely. We talked about this ages ago, didn't we?
I think there are certain films that at some point they're going to come up. It's just waiting for the right time to push the button, as it were. There are things like It's a Wonderful Life and Citizen Kane.
Yeah.
At some point. You know, the mood's got to strike, but not yet. Another film that probably fits that category is Alfred Hitchcock's Vertigo, which, like I said, was number one last time and has dropped to number two. And Hitchcock actually is pretty well represented on the 100 as a whole. I think there are four of his films in the top 100. Now, whenever you mention Vertigo, Tony, you sound a bit like Sean Egan, who criticised Martin Scorsese as a bad filmmaker, because you always seem to say, oh, it shouldn't be up there, blah, blah, blah. So, I don't get it.
I don't get it. Of course Vertigo's a great movie. I'm not saying it's not a great movie. Of course it is. I don't get why it's this high up. It wouldn't even be in my top 10, to be honest. I don't even think it's the best Hitchcock movie. Personally, my favourite's Rear Window, with probably Psycho behind it, very closely behind it. So I don't get it, Carl. I'm sorry. I just don't.
Well, I think its stature in some senses is related to the idea that I think it embodies a certain type of very popular filmmaking, which is kind of personal auteur filmmaking, but within a genre framework. Okay. Mm. So you have a detective story, but actually it's a great film to look at in terms of Hitchcock's own obsessions and recurring motifs and things.
Yeah.
And I think that idea is partly why it's held up in this way. Also, I think the fact there's a sense of mystery about it because there was a long period where it was very difficult to see Vertigo after its original release. And I think that added a certain luster to it. And I think, I don't know if what you're saying, though, is it because it comes with a certain weight when you know that something has topped an illustrious poll like this? Do you think that works against the film in a certain way? Whereas if you had seen it without that kind of expectation, that burden of expectation, you might have felt a bit more sympathetically towards it, do you think?
Maybe. I mean, that might be the case, yeah. I mean, I only saw it after it hit the number one spot, you know. So it's possible. It is possible. I don't know. I mean, I'm going to be an outlier, aren't I, clearly? You know, most people, for it to get this high up, most people must have put it at least in their top 10.
Well, I don't think that is the case. I don't think it would be most. I think we don't have this information as we record here, but I think we'll get it fairly soon. But I would be very surprised if any of these films in the top 10 received more than a minority of votes, actually. I think when we get the results, that'll be the case. I think that was the case last time.
Interesting. We're going to pick a bit of that, aren't we, at a later date, I think.
Yeah, well, I think we want to do another episode when the dust settles, because we've got we got the list, but then as time goes on, we'll get the magazine coverage, we'll get all the individual lists from different critics and directors, and the discourse will spin out from there. So we are going to come back to some of this. But yeah, I would be very surprised if the number one film was voted for by more than 50% of critics. I think it's going to be quite a bit lower than that, actually. So yeah, number one is a new film at the top of the list. Now, inconveniently, a film I haven't seen, which is The Nightmare Scenario.
You will not be... Carl, you won't be on your own. Trust me.
No, I know. The number one film is Jeanne d'Elman, 23, Quai de Commerce, 1080, Bruxelles. And it's Chantal Ackerman's film from 1975. So partly, Tony, the reason I hadn't seen this, because this isn't a film that's come out of nowhere. It's, like I say, it was made in 75. And on the 2012 list, it was, I think, 35 in that poll. So there was a period when I was ticking off a few films, kind of like you said earlier, but I was ticking off a few films that I hadn't seen from the 2012 list, and I tried to find this, and I found that it wasn't out on a DVD release that we could get in the UK.
Oh, wow, okay.
And things like that. And now, even now, it's quite difficult to see, because it's on the Criterion Collection in the US, but we haven't got the Criterion UK release of it. You had pointed out that it's now streaming on BFI Player, but I think that's only very recently that it's gone on there. So I'm going to check that out. I haven't got a BFI Player subscription, but I think I will take one out to have a look at this now. But yeah, that's the big headline, Tony, isn't it? A new number one. First time a film directed by a woman has topped the list. First time a film from the 1970s has topped the list. First time a non-English language film has topped the list since the very first poll in 1952. Because Ackerman was a Belgian filmmaker. This film, I believe, is in French. And like I said, yeah, it's not come from nowhere, because it was in that 2012 poll, but it has leapt up from 35th to number one. So what do you make of that?
I'm a bit surprised. A few people have been saying you should have seen this coming, basically, because this is one of those films that film critics and film buffs know very well and regard very well, but the masses are going to go, "What? What the hell's that?" I would put money on that. You know, like, most people go, "What on earth? Who is Chantal Ackerman and what is Jan Dielman?" Like, you that absolutely will be the case. But I'm still quite surprised that a film which is essentially nearly three and a half hours of a woman in her apartment basically living her life with about three other cast members from Belgium in 1975 is the best film ever made, you know, according to this list. I understand Citizen Kane. I do understand Vertigo, even though I said I don't get it. I understand why it would be voted there, potentially. You know, I would understand 2001. I don't really get this, if I'm honest. I'm a little bit at sea as to why this is the greatest film ever made in that way. So maybe you can explain it a little bit more to me, Carl. I know you haven't seen it, but...
Well, I was going to say, it's very difficult to do that having not seen the film.
Yeah.
And I know that, like me, you're going to go and watch it as well, aren't you?
I've watched the first 45 minutes because yeah. I got that far and I had to stop. And actually, it's quite hypnotically good, like in its own way. It's quite peaceful, really. So technically, I can understand why people would like it so far. So, you know, I'm not digging it on it at all. You know, I'm not saying it's a bad movie, of course. But, you know, I don't quite understand the thought process, I guess.
Well, it might be one we can revisit. We do a section on the discourse called What We've Been Watching, and I think what I'm sort of thinking is once I've seen this film, I will return to it there, because it makes sense given that this has happened.
Yeah.
I think that is very interesting that a less accessible film, both in terms of it's a physically difficult film to find in a lot of ways,
yeah.
And therefore very few people will have seen it, and also less accessible in the sense that it's, it's a non-mainstream film.
Mm.
I think that's fascinating when the previous, you know, Vertigo, I think is quite an accessible film. It's a great film, but it's a genre film. There's no real barriers to understanding there. Citizen Kane, I think, is a wonderful film, but is also, I think, very accessible as a movie. So this marks quite a big shift, I think.
Mm.
At the same time, I think the list as a whole has probably got more accessible when you look at some of the things that have crept into the top 100.
Mm.
So there's a fascinating dichotomy there. Do you think it's because maybe lots of critics, some voting in this poll for the first time, some voting maybe for the second or third time, do you think there's a widespread process underway whereby people are either keen to champion films directed by women, or let's say people who are voting for the second or third time, maybe thinking more carefully about the kind of choices they've made in the past and who's been locked out of the sort of canon of great films, who's been included? Do you think there's some of that going on?
Yeah. I think it seems that way. It definitely seems that way. I mean, I know that Jan Dielman has been described as a feminist movie, and I think there is going to be this isn't a bad thing at all, but there is going to be more of an attempt to get female directors on this list. I know there's a lot more on there now. You know, there's going to be a lot more films made by BAME directors, you know, and filmmakers. Again, there's more on there now. All that's great. All that is really good. But part of me does wonder if a little bit of that is reactive to the current general discourse about, you know, social justice and equality that creeps in. You know, that he's heavily there in film Twitter, you know, among other communities. I do wonder if a little bit of that has crept into this list that might have bumped certain films into this list that wouldn't otherwise be there. And I'm not just talking about the top 10, I'm talking about the whole 100. It's an open question, really. And it's not necessarily that I'm saying that Jan Dielman shouldn't be at number one. I just wonder if that isn't part of the reason it is at number one, really, if we're being honest with ourselves.
Well, like I said, it was already regarded as a classic and it was already in the top 40 previously. So it's a big jump, but it's not from nowhere. I think it's good if critics who maybe unthinkingly ruled out films, whether it's films directed by women, films directed by ethnic minority filmmakers, or whatever. People who may have done that in the past, if they're not doing that now, I think that's a good thing, because I think it's good to interrogate these ideas of what is worthy, what occupies this kind of prominent cultural position, and so on and so forth. And I think these things are never kind of fixed. So if in 10 years' time people think that it doesn't deserve that accolade anymore, we'll see that it probably will drop down the list. So on the film itself, I think we'll come back and talk about that at a later date.
Yeah,
but there are some big changes to this list based on, you know, compared to the 2012 version. So let's talk about a few of those. So one is that some more recent films have made the top 100. So in particular, Get Out, Parasite, Moonlight, and Portrait of a Lady on Fire are in the top 100. Mm. What do you make of that? Do you think it's too soon for some of these films? Because we're talking about films within the last 5 years or so, aren't we? Whereas you could argue that maybe you need a little bit more distance before acclaiming something as the greatest of all time. What do you think?
Yeah, maybe. It's an interesting question, really, isn't it? I mean, there are two of those films, I think, are genuine masterpieces. Two I don't think are. I think the masterpieces of those two are Get Out and Parasite. I don't necessarily think Portrait of a Lady on Fire and Moonlight would be in a top 100 for me personally. But I don't know. I think I know there's a general feeling that, and we talked about this recently, a general feeling that we're in a pretty poor era for cinema overall. But I think there's been some great movies made in the last 20 years, to be fair. You know, they're really, not necessarily the franchise stuff, but there are some great films being made. So, on, you know, something like Get Out is I thought was brilliant straight away. You know, it's like a 5-star mm-hmm. movie or a 10 out of 10 movie. So in a way, I get it. You know, I do get it. And it is nice to see that representation, because I suppose the counter to it is, well, how long do you have to wait? You know, what is the cutoff? You know, if that was the case, should that be part of the rules that you can't vote a film in that's not 25 years, you know, younger or whatever? So no, I think if it's made enough of a dent in the consciousness of culture and of cinema goers, then maybe it does deserve to be in here. And to be fair, I think all four of them did actually in those movies. So I can understand why they were chosen actually.
Yeah, I can too, and I don't have a problem with that. I think that if in 10 years' time, hopefully there'll be another Sight and Sound poll, hopefully the magazine will still be kicking around then. If at that point some people look at Moonlight or whatever and think, actually, we don't think it deserves that position anymore, then, like I say, that process will happen and it'll drop down. But it will always be a film that's been on the list, which means it's, you know, it is a notable film, no two ways about it. Other differences to this list, more films directed by women, like you've already said, so including the number one, of course, and 11 films in total directed by women, 4 in the top 20, 7 films in the list by black filmmakers, and that's up from just 1 back in 2012. So alongside some significant changes, also a lot of continuity. Like I said, Vertigo and Kane, Citizen Kane, still in the top 3. Alfred Hitchcock still very well represented. Billy Wilder, I noticed, still has 3 films in the top 100. Still quite a lot of films from the classic Hollywood era overall, I would say. So it's change and also continuity. In terms of what we were saying about diversity, I think that questions are still being asked about whether this is a diverse enough list or about the type of diversity that is put forward here. For example, I've noticed that people have picked up on the fact there's a real absence of films from Latin America on the list. I've seen somebody say that the list is too heterosexual. And then I've also seen the other side of it too, Tony. Questions being asked from the opposing perspective about whether it has become too diverse, which is a charge that's never too far away in this day and age, of course, isn't it? So what do you sort of feel about that? What do you reckon?
Well, you're going to have this debate all the time, aren't you, with everything these days particularly. I think it plays the middle quite well, actually, overall as a list. You know, I think it represents a lot of decades, a lot of different kinds of filmmakers. It's attempting to balance the scales in terms of that element of diversity. Like I said, whether or not some of that has influenced maybe some films being bumped up a bit higher than they might have been is open for debate. But the fact that they are in there in the first place and their attempts to sort of level this playing field is great. You know, the fact we do have more female directors in there is wonderful. The fact we do have more black filmmakers, etc., is great. So I think it's trying to make this list a little bit more... I mean, it's always going to skew to Western film probably more so than anything else, you know. In reality, that's probably going to happen. But I think it is trying to broaden the canvas, really, and modernize it, you know. So because that's part of the key. It could be in danger of being a stuffy old list, you know, and they've got to make sure it doesn't. If they want this to really set the tone in many ways for what is considered a canon of great cinema, it needs to reflect the times we're in, I suppose, in many ways. And in that sense, there are steps towards that, I think.
For me, I think in some ways the more interesting question is about equality of opportunity. And what I mean is, so I think there is an issue there, like I said, around the fact that there is diversity here, but it's a certain kind of diversity. Now, what I would ask is, well, are a proportionate amount of eminent critics who are, for example, from Latin America being asked to contribute to this poll? I don't know the answer to that. I think we may know the identities of the people who contributed, like I say, fairly soon. I think that's always the first step, is make sure the people making the list or contributing to the list, make sure that pool is truly diverse. And then I think we will see greater diversity. Like I said earlier, I would never approach a list like this as kind of the final word, the be-all and end-all. I think there are lots of great films here and great filmmaking countries and directors and things that are either not on the list or underrepresented on it. But I still think it's a useful list in terms of generating debate and finding new discoveries and so on. Now, what about some of the surprises? Like, we talked about how number one is a surprise, perhaps. There are some things that have disappeared from the list that surprised me. So I'm surprised, for example, that The Godfather is very high on the list, but then The Godfather Part 2 has completely disappeared off it. I was a little bit surprised to see Raging Bull drop out, but that is kind of counterbalanced by the fact that Goodfellas has come into the list. Well, I don't think it was on there in 2012.
Oh, Goodfellas should be on there. I did think of you when I saw about Raging Bull. I thought, oh, Carl's not going to be happy.
I'm fine. It's fine. There have been a few things. So some big Ingmar Bergman films have dropped off, and he used to be a real mainstay on lists like this. I think his film Persona is on there, but Wild Strawberries, Fanny and Alexander, The Seventh Seal have dropped out. Again, Tony, I just don't think it really matters too much in line with what I said about what the real significance of lists like this is. And also because quite a lot of the films that dropped off the critics list are actually in the director's poll that we'll come on to. But yeah, what were there any other big surprises for you, would you say?
No, I think that's it. I mean, the absence of filmmakers like Robert Altman, maybe that was a bit of a surprise. But then I think maybe it's like, and there were quite a few filmmakers like that, where it's like, oh, there's no him. But I think it's like, well, does it in some ways reflect the filmmakers who are more in the discourse generally these days? I mean, how often do you really hear people talking about a Robert Altman movie? You know, for example, right now, it doesn't feel like his name is really in circulation a great deal. Obviously, he's been gone many years, but some directors still have that sort of pulse going on, even though they're gone. Like, Hitchcock's a great example of that. He never goes away. I know he's one of the greats, but he never goes away. So I wonder if there's something to that, to this, that some of the people who've dropped off, or some of their films, there is an element of that to this, you know, in that maybe in 10 years there will be more, to use Robert Altman as an example, maybe his films will be more, you know, current, and people will be going back and they'll be rediscovering them in different lights and, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, maybe. And I also wonder, with someone like Altman, is it because there isn't a single consensus pick or two, in the sense that there could be people voting for MASH, there could be people voting for The Player or Shortcuts or Nashville or The Long Goodbye.
Do
you know what I mean? The vote might split several ways. It might be the same with somebody like Howard Hawks, for example, where people could be voting for Bringing Up Baby or Scarface or Any Angels Have Wings, or it might be that there's a bit of a splintering of that vote going on. Okay, so let's talk a little bit more about the reaction to the list. And I think an area of debate that I've picked up on is about whether it's too elitist as a list. What's your initial thought on that? Is this an exclusionary list that's actually speaking only to a very small subset of people, but not speaking... I mean, you've talked a little bit about this, I suppose, in relation to the number one, but what's your sense, really? Would you use the word elitist?
I don't know. I don't think so. Because, I mean, ultimately... This list is a list like this. Is by film critics for film fans, and we're talking about quite, you know, significant film fans, you know, people who really love this stuff. You know, your common or garden random cinema goer is probably not even going to know this exists, or he's not going to care, you know. But then he, but I would say it has, you know, it has a pretty broad range. Yes, it's got your really culty, you know, stuff that is really deep, deep film cut stuff, like Satan Tango by Bellatar, you know, that's like 8 hours long, that kind of stuff. But then it's also got like My Neighbor Totoro on there, which is something that people will have probably seen on Netflix because they've got all the, you know, all the Miyazaki stuff on there and all the Ghibli stuff, you know. It's got Blade Runner, you know, loads of people have seen Blade Runner, you know. It's got a mixture of stuff on there of different eras. And there is, you know, The Shining. Loads of people have seen The Shining. You know, it's a horror movie staple. I think maybe an argument for that is the absence of comedy, because there's very little or no comedy on here at all, really. And I think that might be something that people point to as making it a little bit less accessible for, you know, because, you know, most film fans, there are particular comedies that they love and they revisit. So that's a bit of a blind spot on this list, I think.
I think there's comedy.
Yeah, there is, but not like necessarily straight out and out comedy, I think. Not quite in that way. You might disagree, but like...
Well, Some Like It Hot, would you say?
Yeah, well, yeah, okay. But okay, there are a few. All right, you got me. Straight away, you got me on one.
I got you. No, I mean, I think there are things like, you know, there's a couple of Buster Keaton films on there. There's a couple of Chaplin films. I think they are, there's no doubt they are comedies, you know?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, maybe that's not fair then.
I think maybe if you're talking... More recently, I think you probably have a
point. So there could be an argument there. But again, I don't really see that this is an elitist list now. I think if it was an elitist list, it would just be really obscure, like French cinema, Russian epics, you know, that kind of thing. So no, I don't see that.
No, I think the litmus test for me is kind of like, you know, if you met somebody who had never seen a film and you gave them these films to see and you were sort of structuring it for them, I think there's a lot of very accessible stuff in here. So I'll just run off a few that immediately jumped out at me when I was looking at it with this in mind. I mean, Get Out, The General, Sunset Boulevard, Spirited Away, Casablanca, The Apartment, North by Northwest, Some Like a Hot, like I mentioned, even films like, you know, Psycho or The Searchers or The Godfather. You know, they're not difficult films to appreciate and enjoy, I don't think. They are very entertaining films, and that's just for starters. So I don't buy the idea that this is too highbrow a list, actually, even if there are challenging films in there, which I think there are, and I think there should be on a list like this, to be honest. I think it does a decent job of reflecting a broad spectrum of what cinema is and what it can be, even if it's, like I said, it's inherently imperfect, and there are ways it can be improved for the next time round, I'm sure.
I agree.
But yeah, let's have a quick look before we go at the director's poll, which... in some ways, I think is almost as interesting, if not more so, than the critics' poll, even though it gets a bit less attention. Of course, they've had people contributing to this like Martin Scorsese and Edgar Wright and I think Guillermo del Toro and so on and so forth. Lots of directors contributed to it. Okay, I'll run down the top 10 in reverse just quickly. So at equal ninth were Persona, In the Mood for Love and Close Up, which is the Abbas Kiarostami film. Equal sixth were Vertigo and 8.5, the Fellini film. At equal fourth were Tokyo Story and Jean D'Elman. So, you know, showing again that it's not just a film that's been elevated because it's directed by a woman, because actually, look, a lot of eminent film directors appreciate it a great amount too. At third on the list is The Godfather. At second on the list is Citizen Kane. And at first on the list is 2001, A Space Odyssey. So what do you make of the director's poll?
I agree with their number one. Let's put it that way. I think I'm all for that, absolutely. I'm also very happy to see The Godfather so high up, because I'm not happy that The Godfather's not in the top 10 for me, personally. I absolutely think it should be. It definitely feels a little bit more specific director focused. You know, you've got people like Fellini on there, Tarkovsky, you know, Bergman, these kind of people. So, and then, you know, Kiarostami and that. So it's obviously one of those things that directors obviously see in other fellow directors or people who've gone before them, you know, inspirations, specific things that the film critics maybe don't put up as high, you know? So I think their lens inevitably as movie directors is slightly different, but I like this top 10 more than the other one, if I'm honest, personally.
Yeah, no, I think it's an interesting top 10. I think 2001 is a great choice because I think In terms of a purely cinematic film, I think that does things that no other medium can do. I'm thinking, for example, of the edit, the famous edit near the start of the film. So I think one of the great things about cinema as a medium is that you can juxtapose any two points in space and time and make a connection between them. And of course, you have the great moment in 2001 where the bone is thrown up into the air and then you cut to the satellite many, many years down the line. I think it's a wonderful moment. It's kind of a summary in one cut of technological achievement, you know. Mm. I think it's a beautiful film. So I really do like that as a choice, as a top choice, actually. Are there any other thoughts before we wrap up? I think one thing I would say, which maybe we've kind of already hinted at, but I'm looking forward to seeing the individual lists. I think it's sometimes fun to read the rationales from critics and directors about why they picked what they picked. I'm also looking forward to seeing which films actually did get a few votes, but didn't quite crack the top 100, but maybe are bubbling under and might come into a future poll. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to that, Tony, which, like we said, is going to play out over the next few weeks or so, isn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely, yeah. It's going to be a lot of fun, you know, looking at the discourse for all of this. And there's already stuff out there. There's some really interesting conversations. There's some other podcasts linked to We Made This that are going to be talking about this as well in our own little network, you know. So, like, Movieversaries have released an episode specifically, so that's worth going and having a look at. But yeah, it's going to be interesting to see this develop. I think the one takeaway that I realised not so long back was that there are very, very few British movies on here. Like, in fact, I don't even think there's any. Like, actually.
I think The Third Man was on there, wasn't it?
The Third Man. Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I think it was.
I think a couple of Powell and Pressburger films. Okay. Maybe one or two others, but then I think you've got British directors but working abroad, like Hitchcock.
Yeah,
But you're right. I think there's a famous Francois Truffaut quote about, I think he said, there's a certain incompatibility between the words British and cinema. And I think maybe that's what we're seeing. I think, actually, one of my favourite films, Don't Look Now, I think I saw in the director's poll but not the critics' poll, from a great British director.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's a bit of a shame because there are some great British movies that have been maybe a bit underlooked here. So I think for 2032, we need to fly the flag a bit more, you know, and get some of these British films on there.
Oh, yeah. Confessions of a Window Cleaner. straight in at number one.
Number one, yeah. Now, wouldn't that be a shocker? Forget Gian Dielman. That's the big story.
Closely followed by Sex Lives of the Potato Man.
Oh my God!
Bombshell.
Go for it.
Oh man! Oh my God!
Dear, maybe not. Sorry,
I killed Tony that. With that.
You have
okay.
Oh dear. Oh.
All right. On that bombshell, I think we're going to wrap up this special edition of the Discourse. Like I said, the Sight and Sound Discourse will continue. We will revisit it on the podcast.
Yep.
In due course, but we wanted to put out a quick reaction to the poll, so that's what we've done here. So yeah, thanks everybody for listening. If you've enjoyed the Discourse and you're listening on the Movie Palace feed, do come and subscribe to us, check out some of our back catalogue. It'd be great to have you on board.
Definitely.
But yeah, Tony, I think we'll say goodbye to everybody now, won't we? Let's say adios for now.
Adios, and yeah, we'll see you very soon for more fun Discourse.
Bye everybody.
Hello everyone, this is Tony Black, co-host and producer of You Have Been Watching, a podcast all about British sitcoms. Myself and co-host Robert Turnbull take you on a range of Britcom subjects and shows in our discussions, including greats such as Fawlty Towers.
Basil, in the same way as David Brent and Alan Partridge and Victor Meldrew, Basil works best when he is actually dealing with assholes.
Lesser known curios such as 15 Stories High.
There are all these kind of like gag setups being put in place in that episode. And then the sort of the end like minute or so is basically the payoff to all of these gags. And it's very, very sitcom-y.
And even top tens such as sitcom theme tunes. If we have to put composers of theme tunes in context for British sitcoms, I think Ronnie Hazelhurst, he's possibly the John Williams of.
I was just gonna say he is the John Williams
I think he is
British sitcom.
We're available on all podcast platforms and on social media at YHB Watching Pod on Twitter and Facebook. So please subscribe, get in touch, and come and have a laugh with us.